This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the filibuster made news again this week when Senate Republicans used it to scuttle a Democratic push for voting rights legislation. We'll talk about some of the history of the move, why it's been used so much more in recent decades, and ways it could change in the future. Now, cooking can be stressful. There's figuring out what to make, frantic last-minute trips to the grocery store, and, of course, at the end of a long day of work and family, you gotta summon the energy to put the meal together. In a new cookbook, our next guest takes a closer look at the pressure surrounding something that we might take for granted, feeding ourselves. On this edition of Food Friday, she opens up about how that stress has played out in her own life and shares some strategies that have helped her find joy and self-care while she cooks. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you deal or have you dealt with stress and pressure around cooking? If so, when does that come up for you? Have you found a way to deal with that stress? Is cooking sometimes a calm and fun activity, sometimes a quick and stressful activity? What makes the difference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Leanne Brown is a cookbook author. Her first book, Good and Cheap, about cooking on limited income, was downloaded over 15 million times after going viral. She's with us today to talk about her latest. It's called Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. Leanne, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's so good to be here.
Well, you cover territory, but you have recipes, of course, in your cookbook, but you cover a territory that a lot of cookbooks don't go into, our mental well-being. Why did you want to talk about that in relation to cooking?
Well, it really came up after my last book, Good and Cheap. I had the chance to talk to so many different people, and I kept having this experience over and over. Either someone would come up to me after an event, or someone would email me, or otherwise get in contact, and they'd often just tell me this story of, they'd say, oh, I love what you're doing, but you know, you can't help me. I'm a terrible cook. And then we'd have this conversation. And almost always what would come out of it was, I'd be like, well, why do you think you're a terrible cook? And they'd say, oh, well, you know, my kid doesn't like my food and they don't eat enough vegetables. Or sometimes the food I make just isn't very good. Or the one that really broke my heart a lot of the time was someone told me I was a bad cook one time. And so I just believe it. And it was just like, so I couldn't look away from this experience because I realized that, A, I love to be able to bring some reality to that and say, like, none of those things mean you're a bad cook. I have experienced every single one of these, and I am a professional. You know, like, this is just a normal part of cooking. And so it was often this really lovely connecting experience, but I also just saw a lot of myself in that, that I hold myself to these high standards and that there's something in sort of the culture, I think in our culture very much in general, but certainly it's in our food culture that there's so much perfectionism. There's so much worry about sort of what makes you a good, as though there can be a good or a bad cook, as though there are these standards and they're all about sort of performing for others. And I wanted to just bring more reality to that and recognize that home cooking is about cooking for ourselves in our messy lives. It is not about cooking in a studio. It is not about, you know, cooking in a restaurant. It's really what's best for us. And that's what our standards should be, and to bring it back to that.
And in your book, you talk about a challenging time for you. I think this is true for a lot of people. It's true for me with young kids either on the way or in the house. All of a sudden, time is a very different thing.
Completely. It absolutely changed me. And it, after my daughter was born, was this particularly challenging time, but it had kind of been difficult before that because while I was pregnant, I had gone through a kind of was an existential crisis for me as a cookbook author, that I had been sick the whole time. I'd been nauseous the whole time. And so I just wasn't interested in food for like almost 9 months. And it was really, really challenging to figure out, one, how to feed my body, which I needed to do, of course, because I was like growing a human being. I still needed that energy, but I was completely uninterested in food. And it made it really difficult, of course, to sort of do my job and do what normally brought me so much joy and made me feel creative, made me feel competent, made me kind of feel like me. And all of a sudden I didn't have that. And so then after, when I kind of got my appetite back, but all of a sudden I didn't have time, I just was like, I just really had to go through this experience of, frankly, helping myself not identify so much with what I make and what I cook as though that's who I am. It's really, you know, I'm much more than that. That's just something that I do. And I wanted to kind of share that experience, and I think I really had to go through it myself in order to have something to offer to others.
Now, you talk about that mindset change of saying, you know, my food that I make isn't me and we don't have to be perfectionists. You also give a lot of practical advice. And one thing I love, and this is something actually we stumbled into as kids, meals that are assembly only. They're not actually really cooking, but you can still come out with a good meal. Can you give us some of the examples that you have in mind?
Totally. I have this whole section at the beginning of the book that's sort of like, yeah, we think of assembly only as like, make yourself a cheese board. It's like, get some nuts, get some cheese, get some crackers, get some little veggies, like anything goes. It can be a fun way to kind of scramble through the cupboards and think about combinations. It can be a really fun way to experience new flavors, I think, and sometimes without the sort of risk factor of like, making maybe a soup or something where you're trying a bunch of new combinations. Like you can just put two things in your mouth at the same time and see what that's like. It could be a really fun way to explore. And I think that's sort of another thing. There are so many people who would tell me like, oh, I didn't have a proper meal because I just like grabbed some stuff from the cupboard. And it's like, that's a proper meal. It works. It worked for you. It fed your body. It's great.
Yeah, I had that mindset, you know, it's like, I am going to cook for my family and my kids. Mm-hmm. And if I was just putting stuff on, like you say, a platter or a board, I'm cheating somehow.
Right.
Like, why?
What? Isn't that so funny? And we all do that. And it's like, where does that come from? Who says that? Like, what makes, why does it have to be hot? Why does it have to look a proper way? It's like, so long as it's satisfying you, it's meeting your needs. Oh my goodness. It's always good enough. I think I've loved hearing from people who've told me that that's helped them too. And my sister-in-law sent me this cute little picture the other day, and she had set out some minute rice and some leftovers on her counter. And she was like, I'm just gonna, you know, make a meal of these things. And a week ago, I would have felt really guilty, like I wasn't having a proper meal. And now I'm enjoying it and noticing that it's actually really tasty and I'm feeling proud of myself. And like, I don't know, it's such a small thing, but I think anytime you can relieve a little bit of suffering or sort of unnecessary guilt, and not only just relieve it, but actually almost turn it into a win, I feel like that just gives us energy, you know, in the rest of our lives, which is really the whole point of eating. It's actually to give us energy and to feel good about ourselves. And if we do that every time, then it, you know, gets us through. Whereas if every time we eat, it's like, I'm worried. There's 18,000 ways to fail. It's not going to do that for us, right?
Talking to Leanne Brown about her new cookbook. It's called Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that thing you make when you got 20 minutes to get a meal on the table for you and a family and a company or whatever? Or maybe just for you, do you have a go-to quick, simple meal that you enjoy? Is cooking stressful to you? Did you find ways to beat the stress of meal preparation? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Leanne, this is, of course, a cookbook and there are recipes. You've shared some with us. I want to check out a couple. Now, you got a crisp and I love crisp. We're on the same page here. It's easier than like pie. It's on that magical frontier between breakfast and dessert. You gave us a breakfast apple and orange crisp. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's so funny also that you said it's easier than pie. It was so funny. My sister texted me the other day and she was like, I want something that's like a hot smoothie, but like not as hard as pie. So we thought of crisp. And so this, it's like a breakfast time crisp. And that might sound maybe like overly decadent, but it really, it's not overly sugared. It's really like an oatmeal meets, you know, fruit kind of situation. And I really love to actually make this the night before because I am super not a morning person. And so it gives me something to look forward to that I know I can just pull out of my fridge and warm it up and it's going to be wonderful. It's going to sort of be everything that I need it to be. It's going to be delicious. It's going to kind of wake up my senses. And it still has like all those lovely breakfast things. It's baked apples, but also I made this with, you know, any kind of frozen fruit that I happen to have around for smoothies. Like my daughter and I have made a like blueberry, blackberry one before. You could use just about any fruit and it will come out really, really well.
And what stands out to this to me that I've never done, I've done everything you just said, except it's orange. You got orange zest in there. You squeeze in the orange juice.
Oh, yes.
That sounds great.
Oh my gosh, I love, I kind of use the orange as a sweetener here to just because I didn't do as much sugar as you might in a traditional sort of crisp for dessert. But when you add the orange juice, it will caramelize everything. And it has, of course, that lovely sort of bright zinginess that will blast through, which I'm obsessed with. I never use a citrus in my house without also using the zest. And I strongly encourage everyone to do the same. It's good and savory, it's good and sweet, it's good everywhere.
We got a caller at 800-642-1234. Teresa is with us in Fond du Lac. Teresa, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about, Teresa?
Oh, well, I was just telling the lady that cooking is definitely an expression of love. Valentine's Day is right around the corner. You know, if you have a boring job, you have a way to be creative now in the kitchen. And when you make something from scratch, I think it's a great expression of love for yourself, what you're going to put in your body to nourish your body and your loved ones. So, and it's healthier and it's more economical. And stop comparing yourself to the Martha Stewarts, because yes. There's a lot of other people out there that I adore, like Pioneer Woman, Ree Drummond, and Ina Garten, and Jada. So there's not just one Martha, there's Rachel Ray. So stop comparing.
Teresa, thanks so much for sharing that. I'm glad you enjoy cooking. And Leanne, I know you've been in both places where cooking feels like work and cooking is an amazing creative outlet. How do we get our mindset into finding those opportunities for that more fun and free side of cooking?
Well, so I think part of it, the trick, at least for me, is truly accepting that sometimes you are just going to be stressed, or you do only have 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so it's about kind of creating those ways that it can be a ritual to create more space in your life, and also to just really accept where you're at. I think sometimes there can be months, even years, where you aren't going to be able to have as much space and time for cooking as maybe you would like. And rather than sort of fighting that and resisting that, you accept it and you simplify what you're doing. And that's an expression of love for yourself, not just sort of in the, oh my gosh, you know, I gotta like, you know, be running around at top speed for 20 minutes, like making the absolute best of this, but actually knowing maybe I simplify, maybe I just make a one bowl, you know, pasta dish or something, and I take my time with it. I take some deep breaths and trust that that's enough. And also that, especially if you're cooking for others in these sorts of situations, I think it's so important, like, you know, others in your household, like your family, that when you come to the table after, you know, maybe a long day, and then you've really sort of overstretched yourself in the kitchen, and you're like, you're like sweating and exhausted from what you've done and frustrated, you're kind of bringing that energy into that connection time, which often means that you're not going to be able to connect as well. I know I've done that a million times. Whereas if instead you sort of simplified, and then you allow yourself to come to the table, you know, having taken maybe some deep breaths and even released some of the tension from the day, you're actually going to get to connect, and that's going to feed you too, just as much as maybe a fancier meal or something more involved might have. So I think it's really about accepting wherever you are at and kind of adapting to that, like really thinking of yourself and your own standards before those of others.
Thanks for the call, Teresa. We're talking to Leanne Brown, author of the new book, Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has cooking been a source of stress or of stress relief at different points in your life, or maybe at different points in this last week? What emotions are tied to eating and cooking for you, for better or worse? Have you found things that help you de-stress in the kitchen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday conversation about the new cookbook, Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. Leanne Brown stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to simplify things in the kitchen? Have you changed your mindset, moving away from getting everything just right and just, having fun, coming up with something good along the way. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got some recipes from Leanne up at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can cook them this weekend if you like. We heard about that breakfast apple and orange crisp. Leanne, you've got another one. This is a fast white bean chorizo and hearty greens stew. Now, it starts with fast and ends with stew, which I don't always think of as a combination.
Totally. I know what you mean. I guess I think of stew as like thicker than a soup, but still can be. This one really is quick, and it's part of the what does that is it used just a few ingredients, but they're all really, really packed with flavor. And this one always shocks me by just how delicious and flavorful it is. I'm always like, really? I don't need to add more of it. It's just some onion and bell pepper, and you could add more veggies if you like. And then sort of the key ingredient is I love fresh chorizo sausage, but you could absolutely use, you know, your favorite sausage of whatever kind if you like something less spicy or if you want sort of a different flavor. And that's such a great way to sort of add flavor to your dishes without having to add like six or seven other different things. Sausage is already full of lovely spices and flavor. And so that gets in there and some tomato paste, and then we're adding beans, and it all sort of comes together, and you finally get your greens in there, and you just have this magnificent sort of far-reaching bowl of super stew that just is amazingly satisfying and truly takes about 20 minutes. And they're not 20 minutes that you're running around. It's really just getting to sit there and gently and carefully do it. And again, I guess the process to me is so, so important. And I think that's so much of how you take cooking from something that feels stressful. I know I still come into it with them. I'm like, oh my gosh, everyone's hungry. I got to get it done. And what always helps me is just be like, okay, Leanne, just focus on where you are right now and just this one thing in front of you rather than worrying about the outcome. Because I think so often we're always judging ourselves by like, is it going to be so awesome? Or is everyone going to like it? And when we worry about that, it's like the mentality of like taking a test that you're being graded on. And it's really hard to just be in the now. And the fact is, it just doesn't matter. Like, not every home meal is going to be fabulous. Some of them are just going to be okay. And that's so normal. And like, we just don't need to be that stressed out that every meal, you know, the next one needs to be better or, you know, at least as good as that last one. It's just too much for us. We can just enjoy that we have something warm and that we've done our best and, you know, tick some of the boxes. And that really, really is good enough.
You can find that recipe again at WPR.org/Food Friday. Another piece of advice you share in the book, Leanne, is pre-preparing ingredients, whether that's having those boiled eggs on hand for that quick assembly, put it in your mouth meal, or having things ready to cook with. What kinds of things do you like to do when you do have that time to get ready for when you don't have that time?
Oh, I mean, I always think of that as like, it's a gift to my future self. And so I love having like treats in the freezer, like, you know, maybe pre-made cookie dough sort of for treats, and making a larger quantity of things that keep really well in the freezer. Like actually stew is a great example. Stews and chilies, they're classic sort of examples of something that if you keep it in the fridge or the freezer, they actually get better over time. I mean, within reason, there's a limit to that, but the flavors will actually enhance over time. And so that's a wonderful thing to do. As well as, frankly, if you really are going for it and you're feeling like, I've got 20 minutes, I'm going to do something so great for myself, pre-chopping fruits and vegetables is such a lovely thing to do for yourself. I know so many of us are always trying to eat more fruits and vegetables. They, of course, help our body in so many ways, but they often come like, you got to do a few things to them before you can just pop them in your mouth, whereas like the crackers are ready to go. So when you pre-chop them, you can actually just grab them out of the fridge when hunger strikes. And that feels so honestly luxurious to me, I find. I also love putting just like wedges of lime or something in water. That's another thing that just feels, it's such a simple thing to do, but it makes you feel like you're, you know, at a special spa or something.
Talking to Leanne Brown about her new cookbook, Good Enough. There's one more recipe you shared with us that I definitely want to get to because it's real cold here in Wisconsin today, Leanne. You've got a cozy cold weather bouillon. I never know how to pronounce this one. Bouillonese. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can pronounce it better than I can. Tell us about it and why it's great for a cold day.
So So this one, I mean, it's just so classic. I really crave like a meaty, rich, tomato-y, fabulous kind of pasta dish when it's cold out. And it's this one does take more time. It's something to sort of spend an afternoon on and really get into the experience. I like making this on the weekend when I have a little bit more time because the smells just make everyone happy. I mean, we live in an apartment building and I know that our neighbors are always like, oh, what are you making? It's just such a, that's the thing about cooking. And maybe again, just that little reminder that you're actually so lucky. Every time we cook, we get so much out of the process, you know, all those aromas. It's like, you get to experience that when you make that, you get to enjoy the feeling and the beautiful sounds of like chopping or water boiling, or even that feeling of like, I cut lemon and it squirted out and I smelled it, but then a little bit got on my cuticles and it kind of stings. And it's just like all so visceral and real and sensual in a way. And I think that there's something so meaningful about that, but that we miss when we focus so much on the flavor and the outcome.
Just in our last few moments, Leanne, you also talk about the idea of practicing gratitude with our food. Could you spend just a minute or so telling us about that?
Yeah, this has been a real big one for me. I think I've always felt that gratitude is hugely important, but I didn't have the best relationship with it. I think I always thought, oh, you should be grateful was sort of my mentality. And if I wasn't feeling it, I'd feel really guilty about that. But so something I share in the book, this little gratitude practice, and that's something I try to do whenever I can with food in particular, is I just sit down and think about all of the people who were involved in getting this meal to me. You know, obviously like there's maybe me because I made it, but there's also all the people at the grocery store, my husband and I, who both, you know, make the money in the house to buy the things, the farmers and the people who put it on ships, and like all of the ways in which this food gets into this bowl. It's actually incredible. And I think there's something, so I often, even talking about it, I kind of get chills. Like I get really touched thinking about the community nature of food and how connected it really is. And that gets me sort of into a true place of gratitude and a true place where I don't feel alone, which I think has been so, so important, especially over the last couple of years where so many of us have felt really isolated. And, you know, we know that we are part of a community and we're all experiencing things together, but it's hard to really feel.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Leanne Brown. Her new book is Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. If you're like me, you like breakfast cereal, and you may be on the lookout for some variety. Well, help is on the way from the world of artificial intelligence research. Janelle Shane of the website AI Weirdness, past guest on this show, trained some neural networks on marketing material for new breakfast cereals and then had them make up some of their own. A couple normal-sounding ones, Cinnamon Toast Crunch with Marshmallow Cream, features the classic taste of cinnamon toast with a marshmallow cream center, and Rice Krispie Treats Hazelnut Fudge, exquisite hazelnut fudge gooey clusters made with 0% white cane sugar. Then things get weird. Non-stick carbonated waffle balls, gold standard for fun waffle ball innovation using wheat-based flavors and crispy aluminum foil. And don't forget original Cool Ranch cheese and dried cranberry oatmeal, all the wholesome cheesy oatmeal with a choice of mild, sweet, or salty. Find more at AIweirdness.com. It's the most important meal of the day. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, free COVID tests, new mask recommendations, and the latest from Congress. All on the Friday News Roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, earlier this week, Republicans used the Senate filibuster to stop major voting rights legislation from moving forward. Though Democrats in the Senate could have voted to change the filibuster and advance the measure, they didn't have support from each member. The holdouts were Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. This is just the latest in a long history of the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. We wanted to look back at how the tool has been used, how it's changed, and how it's sometimes been worked around by both parties. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you think of the Senate filibuster, what comes to mind? What do you think of the changes in the filibuster over the years? Do you think that Democrats should have gotten rid of it or changed it to enable the passage of this particular voting legislation? Or do you think it is a good idea? It makes it harder to make big changes. Call in with your thoughts or your questions on the U.S. Senate and the filibuster at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. David Cannon is a political science professor and Leon Epstein faculty fellow at UW-Madison. He's an expert on American political institutions, in particular Congress. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Can you remind us, first of all, in basic terms, what the filibuster tool is, as of right now, anyway?
So the filibuster allows for unlimited debate in the Senate, and it's been a rule that's been in place since 1806 in the Senate. And there was actually no way to even stop debate until the cloture motion was invented in 1917. So that's been around for a little over 100 years, and that's the way you stop a filibuster. And that's where today we have this 60-vote threshold needed to stop a filibuster. So today a senator will announce, I'm going to filibuster a bill. If you want to bring that bill back to life, you have to get 60 senators on board to be able to stop that filibuster. Now, the rule has been changed over the decades. Sometimes it was two-thirds of the total number of senators. Sometimes it was two-thirds of those present and voting. They lowered it to 60 vote threshold in 1975. So that's been basically the system we've had in place since 1975, is that 60 votes to stop a filibuster.
I want to track back in the history there. In that original system, if I'm hearing you right, it would take exactly one senator to stop a vote, right? If I could keep going and delaying a vote and they couldn't vote to stop me, that's all it took?
That's right. And so, yeah, from 1806 is when they got rid of the motion to recommit. That's what the House of Representatives has, which is a way of cutting off debate. And that's a simple majority vote in the House to do that. They used to have that in the Senate for the first couple decades of the Senate. And then they got rid of it because they thought, oh, we don't need this. It was actually Aaron Burr is the person who came up with the idea of getting rid of the motion to recommit. And so they ended up having that filibuster in place then. All the way, up until 1917, there was no way you could stop it. Now, of course, no single person could hold the floor forever. And it was, honestly, it was not invoked that often. It was pretty unusual for someone to use the unlimited debate in order to sort of, gridlock the system.
Talking to David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at the Senate and the filibuster. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the filibuster changed? Why? What case would you make for or against getting rid of it? Or what questions do you have? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. A lot of the focus this last week has been on Democrats in the U.S. Senate in particular, a couple key senators saying they didn't want to change it. I want to give a listen to Senator Kyrsten Sinema, mentioned her a few minutes ago. She gave a speech on Thursday of last week where she laid out her opposition to doing anything to the filibuster in order to pass voting rights legislation. Here's a little of what she said, making a point about bigger problems.
And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country. The debate over the Senate 60-vote threshold shines a light on our broader challenges. There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. There's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy.
And that's an argument made, David, for the filibuster, protecting the country, she says, from wild reversals in federal policy, making it harder to swing things back and forth as party control over the Senate changes. Can you talk about that that argument?
Yeah, well, I think, there's certainly something to that. If you have a 60-vote threshold, it makes it harder to change policy than if you have a simple majority of 51 in the Senate. And so it is harder to have policy swing back and forth with a supermajority threshold. But I think what she sort of misses there is another really important part of the filibuster we haven't talked about yet. And that is the deviation from the longstanding practice of the talking filibuster. And, some of your listeners might know the classic movie Mr. Smith goes to Washington, Jimmy Stewart, you know, holding forth on the floor of the Senate in the old fashioned kind of filibuster, the way that, you know, Strom Thurmond did, who still holds the modern day record of 24 hours and 18 minutes in 1957, trying to kill a civil rights bill in 1957. So that was the old fashioned way of holding a filibuster, where you actually would have to talk. Well, starting in 1970, they actually implemented a two-track system where if you wanted to filibuster a bill, it would just go on the filibuster track and the rest of the business of the Senate could go forward. And so this idea that the filibuster is somehow, you know, preventing wild swings back and forth from legislation really rarely happened back in the old traditional system of the talking filibuster that was in place until 1970, because the filibuster was rarely used. Like it was used sometimes between 0 and 7 times from the 1930s up through 1970. It didn't come into play that often. So only recently, when you have this filibuster track where a senator just has to announce, I'm going to filibuster this bill, and it basically is dead unless you can get that 60 votes to bring it back to life through the cloture vote. Only since that time have we actually seen the filibuster used as an actual threshold to pass all major legislation. So this is something that's, you know, not one of these traditions that goes back to 1806, the way that some senators talk about it.
Tuesday night of this week, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota talked on MSNBC's The Last Word. Here's what she said about the way the filibuster works now.
We are actually not talking about getting rid of the filibuster, even though if left to my own, Lawrence, I would do that. We're actually talking about reforming the rules of the Senate and taking what is essentially a secret process where literally people just stop the vote. They make it so you can't actually get to a conclusion of an issue and they go home or raise money or whatever. That, as I said, is not how this place is supposed to work. So we're taking what is essentially a secret behind closed doors process and making it public with the standing filibuster.
David, what do you think of that idea of getting rid of that filibuster track you just mentioned a few minutes ago and making somebody actually do something to maintain a filibuster?
Exactly. So that's exactly what Senator Klobuchar is talking about, is going back to the way it was before 1970. And so getting rid of that filibuster track, that's the secret process she's talking about. And the standing filibuster is what people often refer to as the talking filibuster. That's what she's talking about bringing back. And I think she's on solid ground there, because, if you look at the historic evidence, back when the cost of a filibuster was high, both in physical terms, you'd have to sit up there, you know, and talk for 24 hours or however long you could hold the floor, and in terms of the business of the Senate, that it stopped everything in the Senate. If you were filibustering a bill, nothing else could happen on the floor of the Senate. Whereas today, with that separate track, the rest of the business of the Senate goes on, and so there's really no cost to a filibuster. And so I think Klobuchar is exactly right. If you went back to that older system of the standing or talking filibuster, it would raise the cost of doing a filibuster. And so we would go back from, you know, today we have as many as 200, 300 different filibusters in every session of Congress. We'd go back to having, you know, single digit filibusters. So it would be a rare, unusual thing instead of a common everyday occurrence.
We're talking about the past, present, and future of the U.S. Senate and the filibuster with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon. And now we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Were you following the twists and turns this week that led to a filibuster of voting rights legislation earlier this week? What did you think about that process? Do you want to see some kind of change in the filibuster, getting rid of it completely, making it so you have to do something so the Senate comes to a stop so that filibusters are used more rarely? Or do you like the idea that you need, in effect, 60 senators to vote to make just about anything happen? Some exceptions to that. We'll get to those in a minute. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, expert on Congress. We're talking about the filibuster. It was just used by Republicans this week to stop Democrats from moving forward with voting rights legislation and an effort by many Senate Democrats to change the filibuster. That effort fell short. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. If you support Democrats and their congressional agenda, do you want to see them loosen up, weaken the filibuster in some way to pass things? Or do you worry that someone else, Republicans, could use that in the future? If you're a Republican, do you want to see things stay the way they are? Wherever you are across the spectrum, let us know what you think. Or call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. My comment is, if they want to keep that 60-vote supermajority threshold, then we've got to go back to the standing filibuster. You got to earn it. Do the work. Let people see that that's what's going on. If there's 300 filibusters a year, I believe that's more filibusters per year than they are serving days per year. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for the call. David.
Yeah, good point by Kevin there that, yeah, there's more filibuster, more than one filibuster a day in terms of the number of days there in session. Yeah, so I completely agree with him that I think that that would be the way to reduce the number of filibusters, is to actually make it costly again to do it, rather than just having that filibuster track that you can put a bill on.
Thanks for that call, Kevin. Let's talk about some circumstances, David, where the filibuster doesn't apply. First of all, reconciliation. Republicans used it, I believe, to pass the Tax Cut and Jobs Act back in 2017. Tried to use it to repeal the Affordable Care Act, fell short because of John McCain. Democrats have used it to pass a COVID relief bill this year, but fell short on the Build Back Better Act with one senator standing in the way. Why is reconciliation a way around the filibuster?
Right. So that's one of the major exceptions, is the reconciliation process, which is tied to the annual budget resolution. And so it's a limited tool because it only can happen once a year, and it has to be directly related to the budget, to the budget resolution. And so you only get one shot to do that. And so, like, Obamacare also is another piece of major legislation they passed through reconciliation back when President Obama's healthcare bill passed. And so it's something that is a major exception, but again, it's limited in that you can only do it once a year. And so it's not something that's a common workaround around the filibuster.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Richard is with us in Waukesha. Richard, hi.
Yeah, in my opinion, if the Republican Party is going to weaponize the filibuster to grind progress to a halt, I think the Democrats should do the same and show the country why it's so dangerous and prevents us from moving forward in any functional way.
Richard, thanks for the call. David, concerns about the weaponizing of the filibuster. Is there something here about a rise in polarization making parties more prone to use the filibuster when they're in the minority in the Senate?
Yeah, I think that's certainly contributing to the increased use of the filibuster, is the increased polarization that we see in Congress right now, in the Senate, where, you know, for many decades, there was pretty big overlap between Democrats and Republicans. There were a lot of Northeastern, you know, called Romney Republicans, Rockefeller Republicans, were the kind of more liberal Republicans. Then you have the Southern Democrats, who were, you know, quite conservative, you know, way to the right of some of those Republicans. So you have a lot of overlap between the two parties up until about the last 20 years or so. And so that definitely coincides with the increased use of the filibuster, is seeing that growing divide between the two parties in the Senate.
Richard, thanks for that call. We're talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking at the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. Still time for your thoughts, your opinions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, there have been some changes over the last couple decades in the filibuster when it comes to particular kinds of presidential appointments. What has changed?
Right. The big changes there, we're talking about the exceptions before, with reconciliation being a big one. But the other biggest one is the change that happened with presidential nominations. And so especially with battles over court nominations for both lower court, appeals court nominations, but also for the Supreme Court, where in the history of the Senate, up until President Obama was elected, there were a total of 68 judicial nominations that were subjected to a filibuster. In President Obama's first term, so his first 4 years, there were 79. So in 4 years, there were more filibusters of court nominations than there were in the previous 200 years. And so this led Democrats to say, you know, we're not going to put up this anymore. And they got rid of the filibuster for lower court nominations and for cabinet nominations for the president. And those are now subject to simple majority vote. When the Republicans took over in 2017, they removed also then the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations, something that Democrats had not been willing to do. So now for presidential nominations, both to the federal courts and for cabinet level appointments, those are all not subjected to the filibuster because they did change the Senate rules to allow simple majority vote there.
When you lay it all out like that, David, it feels almost like it's a tiny bit dysfunctional. Is there a better way? Like, can we be doing all this stuff in a better way to actually get stuff done?
Well, yeah, and that's why some people say that the answer would be just to have a simple majority vote rather than having a supermajority for anything. And you would have Senator Sinema's, you know, concern that you might get more volatility and, you know, bouncing back and forth from different policies as the control of the Congress changes from one party to the other. But I think there's more sort of institutional stickiness to policy than that. That it's hard to change status quo policies, especially once they become popular. And look at something like Obamacare. You know, the Republicans talked for years about getting rid of that, but when they had the chance, as you pointed out earlier, John McCain, you know, provided the pivotal vote to say, no, we're not going to change that because, you know, millions of Americans now are benefiting from that policy. And so even if you got rid of the filibuster, I don't think you would get these wild swings back and forth, you know, between different policies if the control of Congress changed parties.
Flipping things around, though, you know, when we get undivided control of government, so a president of one party and then both chambers of Congress, held by the same party, the only tool, the only brakes the minority party has is, in a lot of ways, the filibuster. I don't know. Is either party going to be willing to give up that one failsafe that that they would have if they lost complete control?
Well, right. No, it's a really good point. And that certainly has been used in that way by the minority party when they face unified control of the House, the Senate, and the president in the other party. The filibuster has served as an important tool for the minority party. There's no doubt about that. And so that's the flip side of seeing it as obstruction. The flip side is, well, this is, you know, sticking up for the minority party. And there, obviously, it depends on, you know, if you are in the party that's out of power or the party that's in power. So if you're that minority party that's using the filibuster to stick up for what you believe in, the filibuster is a good thing. If you're on the other side, then it's a bad thing. So no doubt that that is historically has been a role for the filibuster in not only the recent past, but going back even further.
Taking outside of the party, if I'm someone who voted for a Republican, say, coming into this current session of Congress, or a Democrat coming into, 2017, without the filibuster, I'm basically completely unrepresented. I have, my votes and the people who agreed with me in either of those cases are unrepresented in the federal government in some ways, apart from all the talking.
Right, absolutely. And so that is the role then played by the filibuster. And, you know, take something like voting rights. It's been a very hot issue, you know, since the 2020 election, where, you know, Democrats really pushed that pretty hard to try to enact these federal laws to try to overturn some of the changes that have happened at the state level. And that's what they were trying to change the filibuster for, was to be able to implement those voting rights laws. For the Republicans, you know, they were saying, well, we should be able to implement laws the way we want to at the state level. And having the filibuster then as the tool to protect that at the federal level is definitely an important tool for the minority party.
In our last minute and a half or so, David, what are your thoughts on the future of the filibuster? What kind of changes do you think could actually happen in the next few years?
Yeah, it's given Manchin and Sinema's objections, it's unlikely that they will agree to even what Senator Klobuchar was talking about of the standing or talking filibuster, you know, going back to the previous practice of the higher cost filibuster, if you will. And so I don't think we probably will see that changed, at least, you know, for the rest of this session. Now, if we get, you know, a new majority in the Senate after the midterms of 2022, then we'll see what happens. But I think that I would guess in the next, you know, 4 to 6 years, the filibuster probably will be at least modified to require the standing or talking filibuster.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, political science professor and Leon Epstein faculty fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We talked to him today about the filibuster in the U.S. Senate, how it's changed over time, and as we just heard there, what the future could hold. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR, and follow us on Twitter while you're there. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll look back on the first year of the Biden administration, the ups and downs, and you can join in with your thoughts on accomplishments and or letdowns. And we'll find out how students of color at UW-Green Bay are getting some help from a local barber. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we end the debate over the most amazing statistical performance in U.S. sports history. We'll hear some of your suggestions as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.